You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. You are watching, listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. Today is 8/25/21. Well, housing, something I have a personal interest in. I either made a great move or a big mistake buying a house recently, but I got it before the major run-up. So I figure if I break even, I am doing well, but wondering what's going to be with housing. And right now, our good friend of the show, a great site that you really need to take a look at, make it regular reading if you haven't already, it's wolfstreet.com. And Wolf Richter is with us now. And if you got a question for Wolf or myself, I would ask you to send an email to kl@carrielutz.com. Well, Wolf, it's been a while since we last spoke. A lot has happened. I think all of this madness is kind of coming to a head in the so-called housing market. And you wrote a really good article that it seems like the bubble, maybe it hasn't burst yet, but maybe it's losing a little bit of oxygen. And maybe the pinprick is coming shortly, but basically prices are starting to decline. I've seen it myself. I get these notifications. People are actually starting to do something that I thought was obsolete, and that is reduce your asking price. Imagine that, people actually reducing their asking prices. How can this be?
Thanks, Gary. This is an interesting situation. Of course, yesterday we got the national figures out, and real estate is local, as we all know. And so every local market is going to be different. I'm here in San Francisco. We have a very unique market here because it is dominated by condos. And condos in San Francisco, despite all the hype and hoopla, have not gone anywhere in 3 years in terms of price, and they peaked a couple of years ago. Housing, as a single family house prices in San Francisco have skyrocketed, I mean, just in an incredible way, separating from condo prices, and hit $2 million median price in June, which is just like one of those moments where you think, oh, what the heck's going on here? And then, of course, in July, they dropped by 8%, and it makes an interesting spike there. Now, yesterday it came out, the national figures, and they're all averaging this out. And what we've seen is sort of what will be described as normalization for a while. You know, the seasonality is returning for the first time. And we haven't seen that throughout the pandemic. The seasonality of housing, so housing volume and housing prices, is well established and over time, over the years, you know, and it just last year completely blew through it. So this year we're getting the seasonality. We're getting a lot of new listings now coming out of the woodwork. So sellers are lining up to sell. And even though this is the slow time of the year, so July, August is the slow time, and yet new listings are coming out. We're getting a surge in price reductions. Of course, they still relatively know that number, so it's not way up there, but it is starting to rise. So that's a jump by a substantial a margin. And so that's a sign that the heat is coming out. And of course, prices dipped. The median price nationally dipped. It dipped 4.1% year over year for single family houses. So that's quite a good dip. In terms of condos, it jumped. And so the average price is now still near the very peak. I'm sorry, I'm just talking about volume here. So the volume fell quite a bit, 4%. The prices dipped just a little bit from the peak, and prices follow volume. Volume's been down. Yeah, that entire spike in volume during the pandemic has been worked off. So we're now in house sales volume, we're below where we were a year ago, and condo sales volume, we're up quite a bit. And so this, these are signs that that there's no blow up in real estate. This ridiculous hot air is coming out of it a little bit, and seasonality is returning, inventory is returning, sellers are returning. So this is the beginning, I think, of a return to normalcy. What will happen after that, after normalcy sort of sets in, we have very elevated prices, and there's a lot of issues with that in terms of incomes not matching it. We know that people that have to get mortgages to buy homes, that volume mortgage originations is down. Investors are still strong in that market. So we've seen that second home buyers are strong, cash buyers are strong. So it's kind of split up a little bit. And, there's nothing like a drop in price to bring buyers out. So if you have a house that you can't sell at that price that you want, you drop the price a little bit, it's a decent house, you're going to be able to sell it. It's not like you can't sell it. It's just not at that aspirational price that people have in mind. And I think we're seeing some of that. And so volume's been down even in new houses now for sale. So there's a lot of supply that came out today. So a lot of supply coming on the market. We've had the most new houses on the market now since 2008. And so it's not like there's a shortage of houses. The houses are being built and apartments are being built and condos are being built. And it's just a matter for the market to sort out the price.
So one thing that's interesting is the fact that interest rates, mortgage rates, are still extremely low by historical standards. And you would think that, the way the Fed thinks, if we just cut rates low enough, that's going to fix everything. But we see this decline in housing coming in light of low mortgage rates. So if mortgage rates go up, just say 50, 100 basis points, what's that going to do to the market then?
Yeah, and obviously that's the scenario we're looking at. Yeah, so the Fed is already talking about tapering its asset purchases. That will likely start to happen this fall or later this year. Interest rate hikes are being discussed. They've been moved forward, expectations of it. Now the asset purchases by the Fed have an impact on long-term interest rates. So that's not the short-term rates that the Fed is manipulating via its policy rates. This is long-term. So this affects mortgage rates and mortgage-backed securities. And obviously, the Fed's still buying $40 billion a month in mortgage-backed securities. They're actually buying a lot more. These are so many of these pass-through principal payments have to be replaced. So the Fed is the biggest player in the mortgage-backed securities market. And it's now going to step back from that, and this is going to put upward pressure on long-term interest rates and on mortgage rates. So, 1 percentage point increase from where we are today in mortgage rates, I think that is fairly conservative. Yeah, last time we had this situation, which was in 2018, mortgage rates went up to 5%, and it froze the housing market. We know what that did back then, yeah. And home prices were a lot cheaper. So when you think mortgage rates at 3% go up to 4%, that will put a lot of cold water on the housing market.
Hey, one thing, a trend that we've seen is the BlackRocks of the world literally buying up homes at 20, 30, 40% above asking price. Are they going to up their purchases with lower housing prices coming in?
Well, I think there's a lot of misinformation circulating in the social media about that particular thing. BlackRock and Blackstone are two different companies. So BlackRock is an asset manager and does bond funds and stock funds and ETFs. So they purchased a portfolio of rental homes. So that was already so that it's an asset producing investment. So they're not buying residential homes, people own. Yeah, they're not in that business. So they took on some rental homes, and income producers. They're already rental homes. Now Blackstone is in the is a private equity firm, and they, you know, they started this whole crisis during the financial crisis of buying single family houses out of foreclosure, and they spun off the entity, which became Invitation Homes, I believe, and so they're doing similar things. But what they're really interested now, what everybody's interested in, is it's built to rent. So where the home builders actually build entire subdivisions, rent them out, not for sale, but to rent them out, and then they sell them to PE firms. And in this particular case, it wasn't Blackstone, it was some other company that bought this development, this built for rent development, and it became, Blackstone is buying a whole neighborhood. And that wasn't the case. Blackstone didn't buy that at all. It was another firm that bought this built to rent subdivision in the Houston area. And, there's hundreds of single family houses in there that are being rented out. And this is really, really a hot trend because these houses are built for rental purposes. So they don't have the same expenses built into it that a regular house would have. And so they use cheaper materials and the nice houses, but they cost a little less to build. And that is the super hot trend right now among home builders. They're all doing it. And it's less trying to buy houses out of neighborhoods. It's buying purpose-built rental homes and have them all together. It's easier to manage them. If you get 400 houses together in one place, you have one rental office, you have one manager there. You've got people to take care of the property. This is a lot more financially efficient to manage than have 400 houses scattered all over Phoenix, which is it's troublesome to manage. So that's what this was all about. And, that 40% over asking, that was another social media thing. And in fact, what the home builder said is that they sold it for 40% profit from the time that they bought the property and built the houses to when they sold it. So, Twitter, you have just a few characters to get this worked out, and it got totally blown out of proportion. But there is a huge trend for these big companies to come in and buy built to rent right now. This is the hottest thing in real estate.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I always thought when they were buying them up and what became Invitation Homes, it's totally inefficient to have houses, single family homes sprinkled all about. I mean, individuals can do it in theory. They own four or five homes, rent them out. But for a huge company, with not a great cost structure, it never really made a lot of sense to me, but yet they got them so cheap. The old saying in real estate, you make money on the buy, not the sell. And clearly they did. So foreclosures, we've had a moratorium for the better part of almost a year and a half. Now they're coming back. Certainly in Florida, they're starting to do them again. Will there be a rush of foreclosures particularly in the non-judicial states, and will that bring housing prices down, or has the rapidly appreciating housing market bailed out all of these people who were basically on the balls of their behind, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, I think the answer is your second point. Home prices have appreciated in most markets and dramatically so. So instead of foreclosure only happens in a down market. So when the homeowner cannot sell the house and pay off the mortgage without having to throw in some savings to do that. Yeah, so when the equity in the house turns negative, it gets very difficult to sell it because you can't pay off the mortgage with the proceeds. So when that happens, you have foreclosures. When you in a rising market, you essentially have no foreclosures. You have a homeowner who can't make the mortgage payments and who then sells the house and pays off the mortgage and often has a little bit of cash left over from the sale to do something else with, has his credit intact probably if he does it early enough, and can rent for a while until they get the feet back on the ground and then they can buy another home. So yes, that's the housing bubble, that surge in house prices that we've had over the last 14 months or so, 12 months, has bailed out effectively most of the people in these forbearance agreements. Many of them can stay in their homes. They're getting their mortgages modified, and so they're stretched out, and payments reduced, and low interest rates, and so forth. So they've already come out. Many people have already come out of their forbearance agreements with modifications or sales. So, but one thing it will do is those people that cannot get into a modified mortgage or refinance, they will have to sell their homes, and it will put more houses on the market. And that's coming. You know, there's definitely some of that coming, and that will be on top of the inventory that is scheduled to come on the market in the fall. So this will have potentially some downward pressure on prices in markets where there's a lot of these. There's particularly mortgages that are backed by FHA that are impacted by this, and they're concentrated in some markets. You know, like Atlanta and Houston and some of those, and so you will. We'll see a lot of inventory come on the market, and it will still probably sell fairly quickly early in the fall, you know, but when this piles up, eventually I think that there may be issues with that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, when you think about where the market's gone and where it's been, you're right. In a rising market, foreclosures are extremely rare because they can, well, back before the financial collapse, you could just refinance them if you had a pulse. And even then, if it was a weak pulse, they'd still refinance it. Now, not so much. So that has to lead to some increase in supply at some point. And the other thing that proves what you said is we don't have the situation of short sales. So, you know, I liken this to what the Fed did back in the 80s when all of the Japanese banks were bust, basically, and they set up the carry trade where they could borrow in Japan and buy treasuries and make an arbitrage profit. And through that, over 10 years, the Japanese banks were bailed out. And that's kind of what the government did. And it makes you wonder, well, why didn't they do this in 08 and 09 if they had just allowed these people to retain these homes, at least the owner-occupied homes, and then basically inflated their way out of the situation? We might not have had as many problems as we had. But one other thing, remember back during the financial crisis, we had this thing called shadow inventory. And to my knowledge, the shadow inventory always stayed in the shadows. I don't know, does it still exist to some extent, or have the banks flushed it all out?
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Trilogy Metals is a world-class developer in Alaska's Ambler Mining District. The company already possesses 8 billion pounds of copper, 3 billion pounds of zinc, over 1 million gold equivalent ounces, and now over 77 million pounds of cobalt. Trilogy's Arctic project boasts an after-tax net present value of $1.4 billion with a 33% IRR. Trilogy is led by an experienced management team with proven success in discovering and developing projects in Alaska. The company is well capitalized, has no debt, and possesses strong institutional support. Trilogy trades on the New York and Toronto exchanges under the ticker symbol TMQ. To learn more, go to TrilogyMetals.com. That's TrilogyMetals.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
But so the shadow inventory, so those, I guess, talking about maybe foreclosed homes that banks had on their balance sheets, that's pretty much gone. I mean, there is for years, you know, there is another type of shadow inventory that's potential sellers who are not ready yet to sell and who will sell at some point. And this is potential sellers, meaning people who've bought a second home, who live in that new home, and you have a vacant home now on their hands, and they're trying to ride up the price increases. And that is a big thing. This is a theory that's spread around a lot among home buyers. You just rush to buy a home, and you don't sell your own home, just your first home, because it's going to increase by 10 or 20% or more in a year. And so if you hang on, it's a leveraged investment. You know, you only have a small amount of equity in it. And so you get a huge return on equity if you get a 20% return on the price of your home. And so Second home bias, meaning people that buy a home even though they already have one and they're going to move into the new home and they're not selling the old home. You know, that has been a big thing, and that's been tracked. We've got some data on this. And this is creating shadow inventory because they're not renting these homes out. You know, they're just trying to speculate, and then they're going to sell it. And there's been some surveys, you know, so the intentions to sell are fairly high, above historic norms for the fall. So people are going to put these vacant homes on the market. What that means is that if you have a vacant home that you want to sell, you don't need to buy another home. So this is additional inventory that comes on the market without demand. So normally a normal home, when you move, you want to buy another house, you put your own home on the market and you buy a new home. And so that there's no net demand increase there. But when you put a vacant home on the market, there's a net supply increase. The net demand increase came when you bought the second home. So we went through the first leg of this. We had this demand increase when people bought the first home. We had this big spike in sales and in prices. So now the tail end is coming of that when these vacant homes are going to be sold. And that's going to have to happen. Either you have to sell it or you have to rent it out because a home is expensive to carry. There's all kinds of costs involved and taxes, and you have to take care of it. So this is not like stocks that you can put in your portfolio and forget about, you know. So the carrying costs of a vacant home are very high. And so this, I think, will contribute to more inventory coming on the market in the fall.
All right. Well, thanks for clearing that up. It's kind of the opinion the shadows inventory went further back in the shadows. You got these few recalcitrant homeowners who've been fighting off the banks. I know one person in around L.A., and she hasn't made a mortgage payment in 13 years, and they were just about ready to really give her the boot because the attorneys were really like seething angry about this. And then COVID came, and then the moratorium, they might still have one in California for all I know, foreclosure moratorium, but there aren't very many like that, fortunately. So
there are some. I mean, you hear stores, but these are individual stores. It's not the millions that we used to have 12 years ago. Yeah, there were a lot of them. And now it's just onesies and twosies and stuck in court and, you know, and all kinds of things. And occasionally one of them hits the media and it's talked about and we know a few. But in terms of large numbers, that's been kind of cleared up by now.
Yeah, there was one in New York and Long Island recently. The guy's been at it for 20 years, and they sold off the mortgage, and they just cannot get this guy out. I mean, they're going to have to get the arson crew in there eventually to just burn him out. Just kidding. That's illegal, and you go to jail for that, and people could get killed. But what does the housing market tell us about the broader economy here, Wolf?
Well, the housing market was extremely exuberant. The broader economy, so consumer spending on goods, so not on services, but on goods, hit historic highs. And that was fueled by all the stimulus money and the PPP loans. And there's $5 trillion that the federal government threw out. The Fed's inflation of the financial markets cost a lot of people to make a lot of money, and they spent some of that. So we've had an extraordinary spike in consumer spending on goods, so durable goods and non-durable goods, so cars and electronics and rowing machines and bicycles, and that was followed by all kinds of inventory shortages and you couldn't get a bicycle anywhere for a while, and you couldn't get any rowing machines, and it's one thing after another, and now it's cars. You know, the chip shortage is impacting cars. So every time there's a shortage like this rippling through the economy, you see prices rise, and we've had spikes in different prices. I expected this boom in consumer spending on goods to taper off, you know, by this time. And so we, in the July retail sales, there's just a tiny little dip So it's not really, as consumers still sitting on all this money, they're still spending, you know, this little dip got a lot of attention, but when you look on the long-term chart, you can barely see it. And, you know, it's how consumers are still buying, you know, and now they're starting to shift some spending to services. So they're, you know, they're going on vacation, they're making hotel reservations and buying plane tickets and doing those kinds of things. And those are services. They're going to restaurants. And I went out Saturday night, you know, as we always do. And San Francisco is hopping. And the restaurants packed inside, outside, people on the street. I mean, I've never seen it like this. I mean, people are spending money and eagerly spending money. And I see that, you know, so this is in the data, it's everywhere, you know, people are eagerly spending money and that's stimulus driven. You know, that is a result of all this money that is now out there. Municipalities are sitting on a lot of money that they got that they haven't spent yet. So they're going to start spending some of this money. And, you know, it's just an overstimulated economy and by trillions of dollars overstimulated. And there's so much cash out there, you know, the markets don't even know what to do with it anymore. And it's caused all kinds of problems in the financial plumbing, you know? So, you know, I don't think there has been an example in financial history where we've ever had this. I don't think anybody knows how to deal with this. And now we've got inflation, but we've got this immensely overstimulated economy and nobody's dialing back the stimulus. So far, it's fully stimulated, going out, 100% QE still going on, yeah. And flush with cash, everybody, companies, municipalities, consumers, everybody. So I think inflation will be the big driver going forward. So a cost for companies going up, cost for consumers going up. Housing doesn't really filter into inflation that much the way it's figured. I mean, it's a third of the inflation figures, but it is not figured in terms of the real cost of housing. So the house price surge that we had didn't figure into inflation. If housing declines, it won't really figure into inflation. So in terms of consumer prices, that's what we're looking at. And I don't see anything slowing it down. Yeah, there'll be ups and downs. There'll be spikes here and spikes there, and some of them revert. But you know, I think inflation will be the big driver here.
I couldn't agree with you more. And it always reminds me of that old saying by the late, great comedian Will Rogers, when he said, invest in inflation, it's the only thing going up.
Yeah, that's probably true right now.
Yeah, so inflation leveraged investments could be your best pick. And look, if it's even bailing, well, the car companies can't put out the cars because they can't get the chips. The supply chain is a total wreck, a total car wreck, no pun intended. And you got to wonder, like, they're getting, like, for Ford F-150s, 70,000. They're getting, like, 10,000, 15,000 over list. These are all signs of pointing exactly to what you said. And that premium on the Ford F-150 is not captured in the inflation numbers.
Yeah. And the used car market is getting picked up in the inflation numbers pretty good. And we've had the CPI for used vehicles jump by 40%, 40%, you know, year over year. That is just completely nuts. And we're probably going to watch this come down a little bit. We've seen that. We've seen two months in a row of price declines in the wholesale market. But the used car market is very liquid. It's huge and is bigger than the new vehicle market. And it responded in something I worked in the car business for 10 years. And so this is close to my heart and I've never, ever seen anything like this. And, you know, vehicle purchases are discretionary purchases. For most people, unless you total your car, you know, you can drive what you have for another year or two and you don't have to buy at these ridiculous prices. And yet people do. And that tells me that the whole mindset about inflation has changed, that people have just spent this money. They don't even care anymore how much they pay. And some of this has to do with the stimulus money. I mean, people got PPP loans and some of those loans were hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, you know, their businesses were doing just fine. And so they went out and spent this money, and they don't really care how much they pay now. And at this point, it's just free money. And so it you know, now with this cars used to be haggled over. Now it's like, how much can I pay you more to get this car? You know, and it's just, just amazing to me to see that.
What's really amazing, I passed by a humongous Toyota dealer in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I live in Florida. And it looked like a shopping center after closing time. There was like not a car on the lot. I'm like, what is this place? Is he going into a parking lot business? Because he's certainly not in the car business, because there's nothing there. And it's like the cars come off the car carrier and they literally go into the shop, get prepped, and they go out the back door in the form of a sale. There's no days of inventory. I mean, you got to think like GM, Ford, and Chrysler, you know, they spent all these years channel stuffing, and now there's no channel to stuff anymore.
Yeah, and it's this complete opposite problem that we had during the financial crisis. During the financial crisis, demand collapsed, and the supply chains were just stuffed full with cars, and there were millions of cars parked at the import locations in LA, and where these cars come in from Asia, and there were millions of cars parked at dealers and their parking lots and everywhere, and car manufacturers had to shut down their production because they couldn't sell those cars. You know, we have two car companies go bankrupt. Now we have the opposite. You know, we have red hot demand. We've got supply constraints, and we've got consumers that don't care anymore how much they pay. And, you know, we've got dealers out of cars. I mean, it's exactly like you said. I mean, the amount of time a car spends on the lot, the hotter models, you know, is essentially zero. They come off the convoy, they go get prepped, like you said, and 2 days later, they're delivered to the customer. And a lot of the cars are ordered. So they have a customer set already, and those that aren't ordered, you know, people just wait till the convoys come in and say, oh, I want that one up there, and I'll pay it $10,000 more than sticker, and that's how that works.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Never thought I'd live to see this day for sure. And now we got the government wanting to give EV makers subsidies again for $100,000 cars. This is insane world. Hey, Wolf, we really appreciate your coming on. If you have a question for Wolf about housing, about the economy, I would like you to send me an email to kl@kerrylutz.com. Make sure you go take a look at his site. To me, it's must reading, wolfstreet.com. That's not Wall Street, that's Wolf Street. And hey, sign up for a free newsletter, Financial Survival Network. Wolf, a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kerry. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Kerry Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.